Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And our guest today will address a subject that's very near and dear to our hearts. So regular listeners know that Dan and I grew up in the Chicago suburbs and attended journalism school at Northwestern and Illinois, respectively, before either of us ever got into architecture. So it's with some regret that we're not taping this episode live at the Billy Goat Tavern under Michigan Avenue, the way Mike Royko probably would have wanted it. But then again, you know, Tribune Tower is full of condos now, and the Chicago Sun-Times building was knocked down for a Trump Tower. Which brings us to the subject of today's episode. Who is the City For? Is a new book by former Chicago Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen, and with photography by his fellow architecture critic Lee Bay, who often writes for the Chicago Sun-Times. So the new book collects 55 of Blair's columns addressing the city's roughly sort of post-Richard Daley era, accompanied by Lee's photography from across the city, and all of it sort of loosely grouped around the theme of equity. So in a city that's been continuously remaking itself for literally 150 years since the Great Chicago Fire, the title of it is very apt. Who is this city for? Who benefits from its constant remaking? So Blair, welcome to Unfrozen.
Thank you so much, Greg. And thank you, Daniel. It's really my pleasure to join you.
Well, let's dive in, obviously, with the sort of the title of the book. I mean, it's interesting because this is a compilation of columns. So it's your last volume of three, I believe, in your work at the Chicago Tribune. But it has an argument at its core, obviously. And so I'm curious, like, what is that argument, if you may give it in a nutshell for our listeners? And who are you making that argument to?
Well, I'm making the arguments to the public. And the argument essentially is that equity is and should be a fundamental building block of good urban design. What do I mean by equity? Well, I mean the fair treatment of neighborhoods and people who have historically gotten the short end of the stick, but I also incorporate the financial meaning of the plural of equity, as in equities or shares of stock. My view is that we share the public realm, the parks, the plazas, the streets, the sidewalks, the transit, the bike lanes that make up the area between our buildings. And this is an important part of equity because we all have a stake in it and we all rise or fall depending on the quality of that shared public realm.
That's a good operating thesis. I mean, in a general sense, what can Chicago and its trials and tribulations teach other cities about resilience, regeneration, or equitable urban design? Obviously, there's been some stumbles there, and there's also been some successes.
Well, there have been major stumbles. Black and brown people in Chicago have experienced decades of discrimination, disinvestment, deindustrialization that have really wreaked havoc on their communities and their lives. Only recently has the city taken a systematic approach to reversing this historic pattern. It's done so under the current mayor, Lori Lightfoot, and her planning commissioner, Maurice Cox. The most significant of their initiatives is a program called Invest Southwest, which has amassed $2.2 billion in private and public funding to rebuild a dozen commercial corridors in 10 communities on the south and west sides of the city. This is a major project of national significance. It takes the vehicle of the public-private partnership, which traditionally has been used to fund glamorous downtown projects like Millennium Park, and employs it to the potential benefit of the city's poorest neighborhoods. What we don't know yet is whether Invest Southwest will succeed. Funds have been raised, very intelligent plans have been drawn up. Construction will soon begin, although it hasn't started yet on the signature projects in this program. Once it is completed, we're going to get a much better idea of whether this begins an essential part of remaking Chicago, making the city more just, more equitable, more fair, and whether it really turns the ocean liner of the city, as it were, in the right direction. So you know, the city, to answer your question in a short way, the city is both an exemplar of both some of the worst urban design and urban financing practices of the past several decades, but it's also potentially an example of efforts to reverse those practices through the Invest Southwest and other programs.
How has the pandemic both complicated and scrambled this program? Because obviously you have the narrative, more in Chicago than any other city in America, of utter lawlessness and public safety. This also dovetails with the Loop and sort of the emptiness there in LaSalle because of work from home policies. I'm curious, you know, it frames a different agenda in a way that the city's also had to deal with. And, you know, there's efforts, of course, to bring housing into the Loop. I'm curious, you think, if there's a destiny for the Loop that resembles the financial district in Manhattan, where perhaps this becomes the next great residential neighborhood for Chicago. How do you think Lightfoot's going to sort of solve those twin narratives of emptiness and fear?
Well, those are really two questions. One is about the pandemic's effect on equity investments of the Lightfoot administration. And the second one really has to do with the future of downtown Chicago. So let me take them one by one. The pandemic has certainly put a pause on the rapid urbanization that was occurring in parts of the city, the prosperous parts, the north side, the northwest side, the west loop, and the downtown. To its credit, I think the city, through Maurice Cox's efforts, has used the pause enforced by the pandemic as a pivot point, not just a pause. So many of these plans, the plans for Invest Southwest, which incorporate new urbanist thinking as well as modernist architecture in a kind of incremental growth approach that's very different from the slash and burn tower in the park designs of the post-war era, have been formulated during this pandemic pause with community support, I should add. So now that the pandemic is easing, there's really a chance to move forward. So in that sense, I think the pandemic, the city has taken advantage of the slowdown created by the pandemic. Now, that's not to say that the urban violence and rioting, which followed the police killing of George Floyd, was a good thing. It wasn't. In fact, it struck at the very neighborhoods that Invest Southwest is seeking to revitalize. That underscores how difficult it will be to remake these neighborhoods. Maurice Cox, ever the planning optimist, said that it also underscored the need for politicians and urban policymakers to focus on revitalization. Well, that's kind of seeing the glass half full. Whatever approach you take, I think, whatever, you know, perspective you take, I should say, the challenge has been magnified by the steep increase in urban violence and particularly gun violence in these neighborhoods. It's come down slightly in recent months, but it's still at historically high levels. So we're going to see whether urban redevelopment can in fact help stanch this horrific trend, which has resulted in the deaths of hundreds of people in the city, and particularly on its south and west sides. Okay, so that's the pandemic, and let's move to downtown. The violence has also spread from the south and west sides to the downtown. We've had carjackings, we've had smash and grab thefts on North Michigan Avenue, and a sense in many quarters that the city is out of control. I don't think it's that bad. I think that's perhaps a mischaracterization by people who watch a little too much of the evening news on TV. However, there is a need for reinvention. At this point, it appears that fewer people are likely to be coming to the office every day, at least in the short term. There are vacancies in the historic skyscrapers of LaSalle Street, the great 1920s buildings. And that opens an opportunity for reimagination and rebuilding and reinvention. And yes, I do think that Lower Manhattan and the adaptive reuse of older office building skyscrapers there does present a template for new ways to revitalize the Central Loop and to make it more residential. Honestly, we've seen already in the, as you referenced, Greg, in your introduction, that many of these 20s buildings are very suitable to revitalization as residential properties. They have narrow floor plates. They have a tremendous architectural character. And so, you know, the question really is whether their redevelopment will incorporate affordable housing as well as luxury condominiums. To its credit, the city's planning department is indicating that it wants affordable housing to be part of the of this regeneration, thereby allowing, say, you know, secretaries or clerks or others who don't make, you know, huge six-figure salaries to be part of this revitalization. So that's important because it's a classic instance of who is the city for. If we're going to redevelop downtown, let's try to redevelop it for a broad segment of people, not just the rich. And that's good. That has many broad benefits. It means that people who work downtown may be able to walk to their jobs rather than driving to them, thereby creating cleaner air because they won't be spewing air pollution into the air that we all breathe. So I think that, you know, there are many possible benefits if the city takes advantage of the opportunities that the new situation presents.
Thank you for that, Blair. So I wanted to ask about what we're talking about, the downtown area. There's kind of two dynamics that are happening at once. One is the idea of the revitalization of I won't say more abundant districts, but districts that have seen some hard times because they're a little bit not fit for purpose, specifically the LaSalle Street corridor and then the Central Loop. And then you have around the perimeter of the loop, you have all these, I wouldn't call them greenfield sites. They're very much brownfield sites that are being redeveloped into mega developments. So how do you see those projects in juxtaposition to each other? And, you know, I know you have a cautionary tale, for example, about the city's front center development that happened in Chicago in the late 1980s. Do you see shades of that with proposals like Lincoln Yards and the 78?
I think that's a great question. One of the things we've seen in recent years is a decentralization of the central business district with the development of office buildings like the McDonald's headquarters in the West Loop. So the question is, can you have a healthy, thriving, economically viable downtown if that decentralization continues? That's one of the big questions posed by Lincoln Yards and the 78. And honestly, I don't know the answer. It's going to take a while for things to play out, for us to see whether people are, you know, going to the office as much as they once did. In a sense, here, what's past is prologue. As you mentioned, there's a cautionary tale involving City Front Center, which is the which was the development name for the area east of Michigan Avenue and west of Navy Pier. A lot of people now just call it Streeterville. In the 1980s, there was a master plan for this once largely industrial district. It was put together by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill and Cooper Extat. It envisioned a vast amount of office space connected by a beautiful public realm of parks, plazas, a river walk. And the idea was that the spaces, well, the idea was that developers would be allowed to build at great density, great height, in exchange for a public realm that really contributed something to the city of Chicago. It didn't work out that way. The 90s office building recession forced a conversion to residential use. The city did not ride herd on developers to ensure that public spaces were built in accordance with the ideals of the master plan. So today, the public spaces in that City Front Center area are disjointed, dispiriting, and unfinished. The most prominent example of which is the Riverwalk on the north bank of the Chicago River. It doesn't lead to DuSable Park east of Lakeshore Drive. There is no DuSable Park east of Lakeshore Drive because the site that where the Chicago Spire was supposed to be built remains fallow, the great hole in the ground where the foundation for that project was dug. And, you know, there was talk about a groundbreaking this year for a new two-towered residential development on the Spire site, but no groundbreaking has occurred to date. So that's a cautionary tale because, you know, when you cut deals with developers where they're supposed to provide public benefits in exchange for the opportunity to build densely and profitably, the public benefits can take years to arrive, and sometimes they don't arrive at all. So that's a major issue for the 78 and Lincoln Yards. But the biggest issue of all at this stage is economic. Will these mega developments materialize given the change in economic conditions that we see from both the pandemic and also the prospect of a recession? It could be years before these, decades, generations before these projects are developed, if at all. So I think we need to be very cautious in analyzing whether they're going to be built, but more importantly, how they're going to be built.
And thinking also along the lines of regeneration, I mean, we can look on the one side to the great success of where the Riverwalk has been completed along the, mm-hmm. the South Bank, particularly of the Chicago River. And then we also have projects of reclamation like the 606, the trail, which actually is supposed mm-hmm. to terminate at the Lincoln Yards development, should that come to be realized.
Or cut through it, as it were.
That's
one of the promised benefits, which I really hope happens. That would be a wonderful thing for bike community.
Indeed. And so, you know, one of the complaints about the 606 and indeed many of the other urban regeneration projects that are along old railway alignments like the High Line in New York was that they're just big engines for gentrification and displacement right. rather than community yes. Benefit, or at least broader community benefit. What can we do to make sure that the next 606 or the next High Line doesn't follow the same pattern?
We have to think of the city not as a two-dimensional checkers game, but as a three-dimensional chess game. In other words, we, in particularly urban planners, need to anticipate potential negative consequences of well-intentioned public space projects like the 606. What does that mean? Well, it may well mean what it means in Houston, where civic groups are extending Buffalo Bio Park to the east of downtown Houston. What they plan to do is construct affordable housing as part of the development, as part of the extension, the eastward extension of that park. They recognize that the public spaces like this have brought gentrification in their wake, and they're trying to proactively deal with that potential problem, not after the fact, as has been done now in Chicago with so-called deconversion ordinances that discourage the conversion of affordable two and three flats into single family and luxury condos. But rather they want to, you know, in Houston, build affordable housing that prevents the problem from happening in the first place. So that's important, thinking ahead, anticipating, you know, the consequences of one type of equity move. In other words, in the 606, I think it's fair to say that a desire to address park equity through the creation of new open spaces begat economic inequity, affordable housing inequity. And that simply, you know, is a matter of simplistic thinking. We'll solve one problem, but in fact, you know, it turns out that another will be created in its wake. So it's a complicated game, city building. And it's, you know, equity, I always say, is desirable, but it is not simple.
Blair, we've talked a lot about policy and politics and placemaking in the urban realm, but we haven't talked as much about architects. And I'm curious about the role of Chicago-based architects and architecture in general as part of these overall narratives. So obviously your book makes reference to Jeannie Gang. She's included in sort of the copy on the University of Chicago Press site there. And of course, Jeannie, who's a friend of mine, and I've worked with her in the past, for full disclosure. But I do find it interesting about how entwined she was with Rahm Emanuel administration, the boathouses, really, you know, the glory of Aqua there, the Chicago Architecture Biennial, which launched, you know, in the last, I forget how many years, 6 or 7, it feels like. But there's definitely been a sort of role of architecture that plays through. And I'm surprised you left out your columns about the Chicago O'Hare International Terminal. The author of Aerotropolis in me demands asking about this, because that was a glamorous architecture competition where, in a black box process, the hometown star was chosen. Even Helmut Jahn wrote that all caps pink memo complaining about the process. So I'm curious how you see how, like, this sort of, you know, this this centering Chicago as a home for architects and led by its home architects. How does that play out?
Good question. Well, you're raising, really, again, two questions. One about why did I leave the columns about the O'Hare competition out of the book, and what role can architecture play in this urban revitalization? I left the O'Hare columns out because they didn't really contribute to the theme of the book, which has to do with equity and, you know, rebuilding struggling urban communities. The issues there really were, you know, what was the best airport design, and were political considerations a part of the selection process? I thought they were. I would have preferred the Norman Foster scheme to be chosen. It wasn't. That's life. And I wish Jeannie Gang and Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill well on their terminal designs. Okay, so, but let's move on to the question about architecture and equity, which I think is very important. People don't live in, what can I say? They don't live in block plans, as it were. And by that, I just mean, you know, plans which show, like, well, we're going to have housing here and we're going to have retail there. The details really matter. The texture matters. The urban fabric matters. Jeannie Gang's boathouses help to draw interest and people to the Chicago River on both the north and south sides, in part through their marvelous design, which is inspired by the motion of rowing. So the serrated roof lines of those buildings are draw their inspiration from the rhythm of rowers. Okay, so that's one example, but unfortunately those projects were part of what I would call Rahm Emanuel's sporadic series of interventions into the public realm. A project here, a project there, a library here, a library there. Impressive works architecturally, to be sure, but not part of a coherent, systematic strategy for revitalizing communities. In contrast, Maurice Cox has developed such a strategy. Invest Southwest seeks to revitalize 12 commercial corridors and 10 communities on the south and southwest sides. And it does so by bringing an intelligent planning and architectural approach to these projects. The planning is incremental rather than slash and burn, tower in the park urbanism. It incorporates historic buildings like the Art Deco Laramie State Bank building in Austin on the city's far west side. It also incorporates new buildings, mid-rise buildings typically, that would signal through their contemporary design that these neighborhoods are alive and vital and not stuck in the 1950s or before. These emphases on architecture really do matter. Because people live with the details, with the textures. And so formulating good design projects is very important for revitalizing these neighborhoods. It also matters because of the need for typologies of architecture that can be reproduced endlessly and for good effect. I'm not talking about monotonous reproduction, but I am talking about something like the city's bungalows, which provide handsome, solid structures that are affordable and appear endlessly throughout the fringes of Chicago. To his credit, Maurice Cox is working with the Chicago Architecture Center on a design competition to develop modern versions of the bungalow, affordable housing that could be reproduced at mass scale. That you need that as well as the signature projects like the Genie Gang Boathouse is so terrific, but basically it's a one-off or maybe a two-off since there are two of them, one in Bridgeport and the other west in the area west of Wrigley Field, far west of Wrigley Field along the Chicago River. So architecture does have a significant role to play here, but that role has to be built on a foundation of good urban design and equitable urban design.
I'm also wondering about the, this is actually perhaps not as well publicized, but apparently the city has a committee on design, which was established about a year ago to advise Commissioner Cox. And it's a pretty diverse membership. Some of the people we've mentioned already, like Jeannie Gang, are on it, but also Reed Kurloff, who's the dean of the IIT Architecture School, Theaster Gates, Amanda Williams, who are activists to designer artists on the, you know, emanating from the South Side. And then people like Ann Thompson, who is from EVP of Architecture Design for Related Midwest. Do you see a leadership coming out of this group? Do you think it's been successful? Could it stand to have more developers or a different mix?
Yeah, I don't see leadership, but I do see a check on bad design. I don't think you can legislate good design, but with the brain power that's assembled on that committee, you do have an opportunity to prevent the sort of awful architecture, there's really no other word for it, that grew up, that sprouted like an awful concrete forest west of Michigan Avenue in the 1990s and the pre-Great Recession portion of the aughts. Many of these buildings were designed and developed by an architect and developer named Jim Loewenberg, and who later really redeemed himself by being the developer for Aqua and the St. Regis Chicago Tower. Unfortunately, though, many of these projects were what I call plop architecture. They plopped hulking high-rises of concrete atop multi-story parking garage podiums, so that they densified the city, but they deadened it at the same time. If you walked around River North, where many of them sit or squat, you look up to the second floor of the building and you don't see like a window with plants and a person in there. You just see a blank wall of concrete that's shielding a parking garage. Well, thinking has really changed since those were built, to the good. One of the examples in the book deals with a residential mid-rise in Bucktown by Wheeler Kearns Architects. That was one of the first, if not the first, examples of transit-friendly high-rise development. It has no parking inside of it, like the Loewenberg projects did. This project is located right near the Blue Line. So why do you need lots of parking there? And it's done quite well. And one can debate about the architecture, which of this project, which I find a little bit busy. But nonetheless, it set an important planning precedent. Now, unfortunately, to go back to equity, the progressive notion of transit-oriented development, again, was not fully thought through. What does that mean? Well, when these projects were built, they were largely built on the north side of Chicago. You didn't see many of them on the south and west sides. And who occupied them? It tended to be wealthy or relatively affluent white people. And who used to live on these sites? Well, it often tended to be Black and brown people who now no longer had walkable access to transit stops. So the city has really, in response to this, Maurice Cox and the city have really tried to encourage the development of transit-oriented projects on the south and west sides. And they've had some success, I'm happy to say. This is another illustration of why, city planning is a three-dimensional chessboard. It isn't a simple matter of saying, this would be nice, let's do this. But then, you have to think through what happens when you do it. What are the consequences?
It's very well thought through, and I like your characterization of the 3D chessboard, because it really is that complex. And it makes it challenging to think about when you're looking at Chicago as such a spread out city, which it really is. I mean, you have a highly concentrated, agglomeration of towers in the Loop and the River North area, but then you've got these vast areas that are still underserved, by transit. And speaking of transit-oriented development, there is a plan afoot now to extend the Red Line south from 95th Street all the way down to 130th, which is, practically it's kind of a food desert, a transit desert. It's kind of an everything desert, but it's within the city limits.
You're absolutely right to bring this up. This is perhaps the most crucial infrastructure decision that the Chicago City Council is now facing. I mean, basically, we have a $3.6 billion proposal to extend the Red Line southward from its current terminus at 95th Street, 5.6 miles south, all the way to 130th Street. It would go through neighborhoods like Roseland that are now rapid transit deserts. And it would decrease the commuting time of people in these neighborhoods to downtown by as much as half an hour. There are those who say that the question of who gets what is a tired trope of architectural and architectural and urban design criticism. Let me vehemently disagree. Projects like this are classic examples of who gets what and who is the city for. It's not at all consistent that some alderpersons are objecting to the tax increment financing district for this project, having already approved a comparable tax increment financing district that backs the Purple and Red Line modernization on the north side. It's utterly inconsistent, utterly disingenuous. And, you know, the notion that who gets what doesn't matter is at best cavalier and at worst naive. Who gets what matters a lot in the city of Chicago, and it determines what kind of lives people have the opportunity to lead. So, you know, backing that project and seeing that it takes advantage of President Biden's infrastructure initiative is utterly crucial to the city of Chicago. And the other part of it, I think, that's very important is that it's not only Far South Side residents that would benefit from this extension of the Red Line. If I'm a CEO in Willis Tower and I need to hire, I'm having trouble hiring people because of the current labor shortage, this would be good for me because it would expand my labor pool. It also would be good for me if I, you know, I'm a cop and I live on the Northwest Side and I'm worried about my property tax bill going up. Why? Because typically real estate development follows in the wake of transit. New transit. So there would be new development in these Far South Side communities. And so that's something that Maurice Cox is already anticipating with plans for mid-rise housing near the transit stations. So that's good because it would improve the tax base of the city. There are other benefits. But, you know, basically what we've got here is a golden opportunity, and the benefits would accrue to the entirety of the city, not just the Far South Side. That's true equity, in my view, because it shows that it speaks to the virtues of improving the environment that we, the public realm that we share.
You know, a lot of our questions have been somewhat local in nature, and I'm conscious that we have a global audience. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about was, maybe to round it out here, you know, you addressed this in a series of articles a few years ago where you kind of looked at Chicago as an exporter of architectural expertise, which wound up on the skylines of places like Shanghai. Given that the dynamic is quite different now, would you revise that thesis? You know, is Chicago still an export market for architecture? And is it going the other direction? You know, we've seen some investment coming from China into projects in North America and elsewhere, although some of it's been pulled back because of conditions in China. I'm just kind of interested in where you see the Chicago and its architecture in the global game right now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the global exporting is continuing. Chicago architects are still working at a great clip in places like Shanghai, Beijing, and other Chinese cities. And similarly, great architects and designers from around the world are exhibiting or practicing in Chicago, and courtesy in part of the Chicago Architecture Biennial, that biannual series of exhibitions brings the world to Chicago, but it also brings Chicago to the world. So Chicago is very much part of a global network. I think what we also have to recognize is that it's part of a global economic network. And globalization cuts in very different ways for the city. Yes, it's provided a kind of full employment act for high-rise architects who want to put in a lot of miles on airplanes and go to India or China or Germany or Poland. At the same time, globalization has devastated the city's industrial base. Chicago is far less of an industrial city than it was several decades ago, when many of the city's workers were employed in factories. And this has had a devastating effect on communities, particularly middle-class communities and working-class communities. So what we have in Chicago is not only a tale of two cities, but one could argue a tale of three cities. And that third part is not the rich, not the poor, but the shrinking middle class in between. That makes it difficult to redevelop areas of the South and West Sides, because ultimately these areas exist in an economic framework. However, it isn't impossible. Cities like Pittsburgh, you know, great industrial cities, have reinvented themselves with, say, a new base of healthcare and universities. Chicago did that to some extent in the 1990s under Richard M. Daley, focusing anew on tourism and the making itself a city that plays as well as a city that works. And that's evident in such projects as the revitalized Navy Pier, Millennium Park, Maggie Daley Park, all of which have spurred investments, hundreds of millions of dollars in investments near them. So it's a complicated picture again. Yes, there have been other good things that have resulted from globalization. You're referring to the investment of Chinese capital in the St. Regis Tower by Jeannie Gang, a very innovative project that took risks as some of the best Chinese high-rises do. It isn't weird architecture, which has been condemned by the Chinese leadership. It doesn't look like a set of pants or something like that. But it's a very handsome high-rise with its undulating profile, the way it meets the street, creating a kind of infrastructure link between the Chicago Riverwalk and an internalized park to its east. It seeks to save energy through the multicolored glass exterior. So I think that, you know, that's a case where the innovations that were occurring in China circle back to Chicago and with a very good impact on the city. But I think overall, the impact of globalization on Chicago has been mixed. You know, and you can look at, like, say, the Cloudgate, the bean sculpture, as it's familiarly known in Millennium Park, you know, designed by an Indian-born English artist, Crown Fountain designed by Spanish artist Jaume Plensa. So, you know, those are great things. And yet, you know, if you go into the neighborhoods and you see shuttered factories, vacant lots, empty storefronts, you see the flip side of globalization that, you know, the bean doesn't reflect.
Well, it is not an unambiguous story, that is certain. And it's not a story that is complete. Perhaps it's never complete. But we do have a finite constraint here at the end of our hour. I really want to thank you, Blair, for joining us and talking about your new book, Who is the City For?, and bringing it all into context for us.
Well, thank you both so much, Greg and Daniel. I really appreciate that you wanted to devote attention to the book and put it in a context for your global audience. I couldn't be more grateful. Thank you.